PodSave the UK is brought to you by Babbel.
What do most of us want when we learn a new language? It's probably not about memorising grammar tables or topping a leaderboard. We're learning a language because we want to speak it out in the real world with real people. And Babbel gets you there fast.
Learning a language with Babbel is all about small steps, big wins and progress you can actually track and feel. Their bite-sized lessons fit easily into your daily routine and are also easy to remember. Just 10 minutes a day is enough to start seeing real results.
Babbel recognises that real-world connections are at the heart of language learning. Their courses are designed by over 200 language experts, real human beings, to teach you relevant words and phrases you'll actually use, so you can start speaking with confidence in as little as 3 weeks.
Babbel lets you practice real-life conversation step by step without the stress. You'll build the confidence to speak up when it matters, from ordering a coffee to chatting with friends abroad. And Babbel is more than just lessons. They even offer a large collection of podcasts where Babbel experts reveal language secrets and offer an inside look at local cultures.
One of my goals for 2026 is to finally actually remind myself of what I learned when I did my A-level in French that I can now barely remember any of. And I'm going to use Babbel to get there. And I really, really want to set that as a goal for myself. I want to be able to travel and be in France and speak the language and also sort of utilize something that I spent 10 years of my life learning. However you learn best, whether it's by speaking, listening, reading or writing, Babbel adapts to your style and keeps you motivated with personalised learning plans, real-time feedback and progress tracking.
So there is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/PSUK. So you can join Nish in his dream, in his pursuit for this year and get 60% off at babbel.com/PSUK, spelled BABBEL.com/PSUK.
Rules and restrictions may apply. Hi, this is PodSave the UK. I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Khan. So Nish, how was your Christmas?
Well, I can tell you it was fantastic and definitely has happened. And we are not in any way, shape or form recording this on the 17th of December, immediately after we recorded the last episode.
I'm just surprised they've let us do an episode, just me and you.
Yeah.
No guest. That feels chaotic.
We have done these before. I don't know why you're so worried about
it. Listen, we always need a third niche. It's very important. Today is the day. We're digging into the mailbag to answer your questions. All of life is here, from our most conservative opinions to why the left make it so fucking hard.
We've also got questions to answer on what public services we'd introduce, why some people oppose NATO, and a big one, is the human race doomed? I mean, that is, I would say, maybe a question beyond our powers of cognitive function. In fact, actually, all of those questions. I'm not saying, of course, we'll be able to redraft a structure of NATO that will be more amenable to countries of the global south. But the question of the apocalypse is beyond our powers.
First of all, I just want to thank everyone who sent in questions. Our inbox was flooded and they really kept our producers entertained. But this is actually the first time that Nish and I are seeing them. So, drum roll. You going to drum roll, mate?
Oh, sorry.
You're the musical one. Our first question is from Kyle. He asks, what are your most conservative stroke least left-wing opinions?
Okay, so we actually have discussed this previously in a podcast. And at the time, you expressed some very strong feelings about boy racists.
And the reason I think it's a conservative, because, you know, in general, I consider myself someone that's like pro da kids.
Yeah.
Da youth. The young ones, the youngsters. I'm very pro that. I don't really like it when people
age. I don't know
age.
What just happened there. Just so that the listeners and viewers know, I'm as confused as you are about what just happened.
I don't like it when people age and then they're like, oh, the music's not as good as it used to be, or the kids these.
I agree with that.
I find
that
annoying.
Yes.
And boy racing is a pastime of young people.
Sure.
So it's probably me bashing the young, which is, you know, I would say probably my most conservative opinion in that way.
Kyle basically has expanded this point and said, I'm with Coco about boy racers and would expand that out to teenagers on bikes and e-scooters, or, and this may be where we diverge from you, Kyle, or even just teenagers more broadly.
Just teenagers completely.
Kyle, when you say more teenagers more broadly, do you mean the concept of teenagers? Another listener, Chris, wanted to know, how does Coco Khan reconcile? We really are seeing these for the first time and I'm really enjoying it. How does Coco Khan reconcile her hatred of boy racers with her love of the Fast and Furious movies?
Well, that is a good question.
Long-standing listeners will know that Coco is a huge aficionado of the entire Fast and Furious franchise.
So this is interesting because I would say that the Fast and the Furious movies, yeah, there's a lot of cars, but it's not really about the cars. Yeah. Really, it's about chosen family. And really, it's about, you know, the things that we have to do for those that we love.
Yeah.
You know? And I cannot see into the psyche of the boy racers that race up and down outside my flat and wake up my baby all the time for a sense of machismo. Maybe they too do it for their families. I don't know.
Well, so is this still your most conservative opinion? It's still your most conservative opinion.
Yes, that and obviously that some kinks are meant to be shamed.
Oh, okay, yeah. Which kinks?
No, we're not getting into that. That's how I get cancelled.
So there
anyway,
are some kinks you...
Some kinks should be shamed. I'm just saying, some of them.
Okay, fine.
Some of them are fine. Anyway, I've exposed myself. So how about your most conservative opinion?
I think my most conservative opinion and my most conservative mindset is all probably loosely around the Second World War.
I was not expecting
Think I would like to think of myself as a pacifist, and I certainly think we have a problem with fetishizing war and the military. But I do think the Second World War was good. That was a good war. I think sometimes you have to blow up a Nazi. I think Europe dragging its feet was a bad thing. I don't think
this is fair. You can't go to history.
But this is a pretty conservative opinion, I'd say.
Would you?
Yeah, you know, I think you do sometimes have to have a war because there are people that you need to protect, and sometimes that protection has to happen militarily. I think that is my most conservative opinion. Do you not think so?
Well, I don't know.
This is the default progressive position, no war ever.
Well, I guess it depends, isn't it? You know, we've just discussed before how we have relatives in our family who are so left-wing, they're like, you know, armed resistance always.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I suppose it depends. But really what I wanted to hear you say... What are some conservative opinions I've heard you say in our years of...
I fly a lot for work. So that's pretty conservative,
that's good.
Right?
That's one.
Because I can't drive. I do eat meat. I don't eat beef, but I do eat meat. So that's a sort of blot on my progressive credentials.
Well, we got there in the end. Okay, let's move on to our next question. So our next question is from at Simon Manley 9245. They want to know, why is it that a lot of politicians away from the centre have a problem with NATO? I've heard Polanski cite US unreliability and Farage used the same language as Nathan Gill, but neither seems to explain why NATO is a bad thing.
So, look, there's a context here, and there are very different reasons why people on the left and people on the right oppose NATO. So, on the left, someone like Zach Polanski, and obviously Zara Sultana, who's gone even further than Zach Polanski on this, see NATO as a militaristic organisation which prioritises nuclear weapons over diplomacy, which is obviously not a great thought when the influence of someone like Donald Trump is considered. And I mean, listen, NATO, because of the organisation of it, it's literally the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, it is, and I think with some justification, viewed with suspicion by the countries in the global south, countries in Africa. There is a concern that it's an organization that is about consolidating specifically Northern European military power. And so I think that that's a reason why there is some suspicion around it, certainly from the progressive quarters. I think that there are justifiable concerns. I think at this moment, you have to be realistic about the geopolitical situation and look at, you know, Vladimir Putin is a kind of rampant militaristic imperialist. And it feels like an odd time to be wavering your support for NATO when it is a bulwark against Putin. And, you know, there are obviously people on the left that would accuse NATO of itself being an imperialist organization. And it is a very, very complicated conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason that we questioned the your party position on it is that it feels like an odd time to be going after NATO, given that it's kind of in a kind of territorial struggle with Putin at the moment, who is trying to aggressively expand Russia's borders. Whereas for the political right, or at the very least Reform Party, it is a bit more complicated. So Nigel Farage's position has shifted. So originally he said that NATO provoked Russia with its expansion towards Russia's borders. He faced accusations of fawning over Putin, which seemed to prompt him to be more pro-NATO and anti-Putin. So earlier this year, Farage acknowledged that Ukraine probably should join NATO as part of a long-term peace plan. The latest is that Ukraine may accept some security protections rather than membership if it helps get this peace deal over the line.
So next up, a question from Joshy. When the show began, they write, you were both Labour supporters. Obviously, a lot has happened since. And yes, the general election is a long way away. But what party would you support now, or what is your gut feeling telling you to lean towards? Ooh.
Oh, that's sticky.
Oh, that's hard.
We should say Joshy also has added, personally, I'm a Your Party member. It's my first party membership. It'll be my first time voting and I'm 39. I finally found my people. I've actually never been a member of a political party, in spite of what you might have read about me in the Daily Mail. I've never been a member of the Labour Party.
Yeah,
I've never been a member of the
Labour
Party or the Communist Party.
You
know, I think it's great to push back on political parties at all times and not allow your affiliation to them supersede your ability to think critically about them. I mean, where I am at the moment, the reality is historically, the Labour Party in the United Kingdom has been the best delivery mechanism for the political principles that I really hold dearest. You know, it's obviously a much more complicated conversation than this, but there was a point when one day people in this country woke up and regardless of their economic circumstances, they had access to free healthcare on the point of delivery. That is an enormous, enormous change for particularly working class people in the United Kingdom. And that was delivered by a Labour government. There are principles that I hold dear that the Labour Party has historically been the best vehicle for. I will always vote for the party I believe is in the best position to deliver the things that are important to me. And the things that are important to me is ultimately equality and freedom. Those are the two most important things to me. The circumstances of your birth should not dictate the outcome of your life. That is the fundamental principle that is most important to me in every facet of my life. And it covers everything in many ways. It covers, you know, social class. It covers if you're gay or lesbian or transgender. It covers if your parents are white or if your parents are black or if your parents are Asian or if your parents are South Asian, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That fundamental principle is at the cornerstone of everything that I believe in. And I will always vote for the party that is best positioned to deliver that. Now, there are going to be times where that's not on the ballot paper. And when that happens, I vote for what's in front of me. I've never not voted in an election. I've never, ever done that. Again, because too many people have given up too much for me to be in a position to elect a government. And I respect people who spoil their ballot paper. I respect people who, you know, out of conscience said, I cannot vote for any political party that is supporting the action that Israel is taking in Gaza or that the US and the UK was taking in Iraq and Afghanistan. I've always approached these things with a mixture of idealism and pragmatism. But if I'm being completely honest, if I get to the ballot paper and it's a choice between someone who I think is fucking useless or Nigel Farage, then the fucking useless party is getting the vote.
I think you sort of hit the nail on the head there about like, it's about the principles and it's about the values and who reflects that. We both would consider ourselves Labour supporters. I personally have voted away from Labour when I have felt that actually that's not right for my values at that time. But yeah, I still believe in myself that I am a Labour supporter. And so maybe naively, or maybe I'm clinging on to old times, but I still feel that because of the history of the Labour Party and the fact that it is bigger than just the government, it is bigger than the PLP, it is a movement, it's affiliates, it's all sorts of people, that still has within it the potential to move Britain in a direction that I want it to do. But as I said, when it comes to it, exactly as you put it, when it comes to the general election, we shall look at who's on the ballot. We shall look at what the Labour Party is offering. We shall look at how the party has changed and we'll make a decision. And it's always just voting about what those values are. Who am I leaning towards at the moment? Honestly, at the moment, I feel quite politically homeless. I really like a lot of what Zach Polanski is saying, but he's only been leader for however long.
Yeah.
The Green Party before Zach was, you know, had loads of great things going for it, but it wasn't exactly Zach's way. I mean, he had to win that contest and he's changing the party. But, you know, at the minute, I just don't know. I put a lot of stock by like history and tradition in that regard, I suppose.
On this subject, you touched on this in your answer to the last question. Olivia from Australia has written in and asked, I'm interested in why people who lean left wing in the UK choose to vote Labour when they continuously let voters down and try to appease the right, rather than backing the Green Party. Does the fact that the UK doesn't have preferential voting influence your decisions? And is it something you'd like to see brought in? She also wanted to know, and again, this is a discussion we've had because of our Australian listeners and Australian guests we've had on the show, would you like to see compulsory voting introduced. So just to really briefly summarise for people who don't live in countries with preferential voting is where voters rank the candidates, with one being the highest preference, and the second choice gets two and onwards, depending on how many candidates are on the ballot paper. If a candidate wins the majority of first preference votes, they are the winner. If not, then the candidate with the least votes is eliminated. Then all the people who voted for this candidate will have their second preferences added to the pot. And this process is repeated until someone wins an outright majority. And to be clear, compulsory voting around 20 countries, including Australia, use this system. Penalties for not voting without a proper justification vary wildly. So across all the elections that we have in the UK, whether it's a general election, local election, council election, mayoral election, there are five different active voting systems in use. So there's first past the post, alternative vote, supplementary vote, single transferable vote, and additional member system. So look, a lot of information there, but just to give you all of the variables as we have this conversation, there's three questions here really that Olivia's asking. Why do left-wing voters still vote for the Labour Party rather than backing the Greens? Does the fact that the UK doesn't have preferential voting influence your decisions? And would you like to see it brought in? And do you want to see compulsory voting?
Okay, so let's start with the first one. Why do voters continuously vote Labour? I mean, to be fair, when Labour were up for election, I think a lot of people that voted for Labour didn't know exactly how this Labour Party was going to turn out and probably looked back on previous Labour governments and previous Labour leaders. Yes. So I don't know if it's necessarily fair to say that those people voted Labour and they let everyone down. They, you know, there's a certain amount of like hope that was involved, and also a certain amount of them being the only party that could feasibly take on the Tories and needing to get them
out. And that does bring in what Olivia's saying about the voting system. So the first past the post system favours these two parties. Yeah. Also, in terms of backing the Greens, it is a more complicated picture in the United Kingdom, only because particularly in the last decade, progressive voters in Scotland have started to turn en masse towards the SNP because along with the progressive things that they believe in, they also want to see the country of Scotland independent from the United Kingdom. And there is also a chunk of progressive voters that in Wales goes to Plaid Cymru and in Northern Ireland goes to Sinn Féin. So your question, Olivia, of going, why do you not go straight from Labour to Green is slightly complicated by the issues that occur within specific countries in the United Kingdom as well. So there's that factor as well.
Does the fact that the UK doesn't have preferential voting influence your decision? Yeah, of course you have to make considerations in 100%. Terms of first past the post. Yeah. I think that's fair. Tactical voting was an enormous part of the last election, and I expect it probably will be for this one as well.
Yeah.
So, that certainly does factor. And would I like to see compulsory voting introduced? Honestly, no.
Yeah.
I just think it's antithetical to democracy. I think the parties need to make better offers, and they should be forced to make better offers to win votes.
I agree with you. It's something I talk to my Australian friends and Australian family, and it's something that we talk about a lot. My Aussies are really pro compulsory voting. They say, I can't understand why you wouldn't do
it. I guess the logic
also, fine is cursory in Australia particularly. It's not a huge amount of money.
I suppose the logic is that, like, well, it forces people to engage with politics. But just because you're forced to engage in an election, it doesn't necessarily mean that you engage with it, all year round. It doesn't necessarily mean that you'll engage with it in a way that is genuinely meaningful. I mean, people still vote monster raving loony party. People still vote for that man with the bin on his head.
People definitely draw dicks on the ballot paper. Yeah. Definitely, definitely. Just in brief, yes, I would like to see some change brought into the UK's electoral system because I think first past the post is kind of holding the country back. And I also am instinctively not in favour of compulsory voting. There's something that just doesn't sit right with me.
After the break, we'll be putting forward our ideas for the progressive policies we want to see become a reality.
Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Shopify.
You should make 2026 the year you launch your business. I know you've been thinking about it, so get going now. Make this the year you transform into an entrepreneur, a founder, a boss. One powerful move puts your future firmly in your hands, and that is starting that business with Shopify. So if you've got an idea that you just can't shake, a craft that everyone's telling you to sell, or maybe you've got a store in your head, with Shopify, you can make it happen in 2026.
Shopify gives you everything you need to sell online and in person. Millions of entrepreneurs have already made this leap from household names to first-time business owners that are just getting started.
Shopify gives you all the tools to easily build your dream store. Choose from hundreds of beautiful templates that you can customize to match your brand.
Marketing is built in as well. Create email and social media campaigns that reach customers wherever they scroll. And as you grow, Shopify grows with you. Handle more orders, expand to new markets, and do it all from the same dashboard.
In 2026, stop waiting and start selling with Shopify.
Sign up for your £1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
Go to shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
That's shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk. Hear your first this new year with Shopify by your side.
Quick question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero handholding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
Okay, so we have an excellent question from Nick. Imagine you are campaigning for the Progressive Party on a platform that will introduce universal public services to make people's lives better. What new services would you introduce? Now, Nick does actually have some suggestions for us, Coco.
And they are very good suggestions. So they suggest a health MOT. So everyone has a yearly visit to their GP to discuss their physical and mental health, their lifestyle, a universal adult education. We normalise lifelong learning. All adults are entitled to attend a few weeks worth of education per year and take paid leave from work to enable them to do so. Just, I really like this because I am increasingly seeing lots of my journalist colleagues facing the fact that journalism is in decline. And so lots of them are retraining. And this idea of a job for life, it seems to be gone.
Yeah.
So how can you retrain unless there's good adult education if we are living in this fast-paced tech world where, you know, move quickly, break things, and people should at least have that education security net when they need to change their lives.
Listen, I think all of those ideas are incredibly interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, new services, the health MOT is amazing, and I imagine it is something we would introduce if our GPs were not horrendously overstretched. But I think low-cost, affordable, efficient public transport would really transform the lives of lots of people in this country. There are lots of areas that are not served well by train routes. There are lots of areas that are not served well by bus routes. And I know about all of them because I am a stand-up comedian who cannot drive a car.
Social care, more stuff on that, please.
Yeah,
that'd be a good policy.
Well, and also if you want to help the National Health Service, you have to do something about social care because the cuts to social care have essentially created a kind of constant strain on the NHS. So like it is a really important issue.
And then the last one, sorry, my other small idea that I think might be good is about, so I read this thing about how, and like obviously there's loads of problems with property and the fact that property prices have gone through the roof and that incentivizes people to hang on to those homes because also they think of them as their pension. Actually, maybe we should have better pensions, blah, 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 blah. So there's also, but apparently one of the reasons as well this happens is because the process of downsizing to a small flat is a lot harder. So you get loads of millennials and young families in small flats and then older people in these houses. Anyway, I think there should be a national downsizing initiative. A bit like changing rooms where people come over and help you.
Yeah.
We could get that guy, Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen. He could do it. He could appear like that sort of fabulous vampire that he is.
Yeah.
And he could help people go downsize in a fabulous way. It's just an idea.
Okay, let's move on. Our next question is from Luke from North Wales. He asks, how do countries measure productivity and GDP if most of what they offer is services such as teaching and a free NHS? If there is nothing to sell, is this way of measuring an economy always going to make progressive ideas seem like a bad thing as they will lower the productivity forecast? And he adds, the more I read, the more I feel the idea of the global economy is made up to promote profiteering and exploitation, yet punish any sense of doing something good for the benefit of others. In short, is the world just set up to benefit knobheads?
Well, it does feel like that, doesn't it? It really does. I'm so into this. I'm so over GDP.
Right.
Leave it in the past. It's so useless. Like the fact that you know, I don't know, you can burn a load of trees and then that will make your GDP go up that year, but you have literally destroyed the asset of your nation. Yeah. That happens all the time, the kind of removal of assets from the country to improve this GDP. And yeah, fine, you know, it's the whole thing with like Keir Starmer talking about the AI business and, you know, members of the Labour Party quietly saying, yeah, creatives, don't worry if they take your work. Don't worry about it because, you know, at the end of the day, it will improve GDP, but all that money will go to one, to use Luke's language, knobhead.
Yeah,
won't
yeah.
It'll go to one knobhead.
So look, GDP came into use in the 1930s in the United States as it tried to measure and understand the Great Depression. But the man credited with the idea, Simon Kuznets, admitted it was not a measure for the welfare of a nation. There are other measures for inequality and for happiness, but the problem that we've understood with gross domestic product and economic growth as a measure of the welfare of a nation is that there was an assumption for years and years and years that trickle-down economics was an absolute, infallible principle, and that if the country's economy grew and if the GDP was healthy, that benefit would reach all of the citizenry through trickle-down economics. And what we learned, particularly in the post-2008 period, is that it is totally possible to have a growing economy that benefits no one in your country.
Yeah.
Like the Conservative Party constantly used to say, we have got a constantly growing economy through the 2010s. Didn't help any of us.
Yeah.
Didn't help any of us. And actually, there has been a conscious effort to decouple economic growth and a healthy GDP from actual investment in the country. And so it's not what you've got, it's what you do with it.
Yes.
Be it GDP or the human penis.
So...
it's not all
philosophy
about...
philosophy we can always live
it's
by.
It's not all about growth.
Yes. No, it's not. So Bhutan uses the gross national happiness, which measures the population's collective happiness and well-being instead, which is kind of amazing. The idea came from the fourth king of Bhutan, Jingme Singye Wangchuck, I hope I've said that right, in 1972, who declared it more important than GDP. Yes. The UN publishes the Human Development Index, HDI, which is a composite indicator of life expectancy, education and per capita income. There's also an inequality adjusted HDI. So, like, there's other measures out there. There's also the Gini coefficient. Ooh, that's easy to remember that one. The Gini coefficient measures inequality to show how income and wealth is distributed. You know, years ago, I did a piece about, like, how much money do you need to make you happy? And at the time, I was investigating, like, on an individual level because there was all this conversation. I mean, do you remember there was that guy who stood up on Question Time that was like, I earn 80K and that's not very much. And so I wanted to get to the heart of, like, well, how much actual money do you need to kind of feel comfortable? And ended up talking to this kind of happiness economist. I don't think that's what they're called. And the conversation ended up moving to the parallels with human happiness and national happiness.
Yeah.
So essentially with money, if you don't have much of it and you double your income, you feel a lot happier. But as you keep doubling, it's like diminishing returns, right? And eventually you can get to the point where you have so much money that you start to feel unhappy and you start to see a decline in happiness. Yeah. Apparently that's the same for countries.
Right.
So when countries, you know, if you talk about like, oh, we are the richest country in the nation, a lot of those countries at the top have some of the lower happiness ratings because of this feeling that, well, if I have this money, then I need to have purpose for it. If I have this money, I need to be doing something for it. And that's where things like fairness and sustainability and social justice really matter.
Now,
this isn't to say that billionaires are great vehicles for this, even though they may feel them. But it's more about this idea of purpose and that being so closely linked to money. It's something that we've lost.
Listen, the figures that matter to me that I think are ultimately more important than our gross domestic product are the figures that I'm looking at right now from the Child Poverty Action Group's website. 4.5 million children are growing up in poverty in the UK. 7 out of 10 children living in poverty have at least one parent in paid work.
Mm.
That is the crucial figure. If you're measuring a country's well-being by anything, it should be how well it is taking care of its children. That's the most important figure. And what we need to do is we need to reconnect economic growth with actual beneficial outcomes for the poorest people living in our societies. Those are the figures that matter. I find the phrase in-work poverty to be the most depressing three-word phrase in the English language, apart from starring Jared Leto. Those are the two most depressing phrases in the English language.
Also, you said at least one of those parents is in work.
Yeah.
I just thought, there was a time where only one parent needed to work. But anyway, let's move on. So a couple of people wrote in to ask, where do you both get your news from? Do you have any recommendations for reliable or at least balanced news outlets? Listener Zoe also wants to know your favourite podcast, our favourite podcast. Do we stick to news and current affairs? Or do we prefer switching off to something completely unrelated?
In terms of podcasts, I mean, I am a like 2010 era podcast listener. And as such, have been bereft by Mark Maron's decision to end WTF. That is one of, in a year of low points, that was one of the lowest points for me. I'm very happy for Mark Maron. I'm happy he's found peace. Show business is a difficult career. You don't often get to choose the manner in which you exit. He has been able to do that. But at the same time, what the fuck am I supposed to do on a Monday and Thursday now? What have you done to me, Maron?
One of my like podcast things I do is I listen to history podcasts to fall asleep.
Yeah.
Because history podcasts are nearly always presented by some sort of softly spoken posh guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Always. I know the beginning of so many historical eras, but then I fall asleep. I know the beginning of, you know, Captain Cook's journey. I know the beginning of, you know, so many conversations about Roman noses.
Yeah.
But they just start talking to me and I just, it's amazing. I basically go to sleep with Dan Snow every night.
I obviously listened to those two morons talking about food.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to say the name of the podcast. They don't need more
plugging
from me. But my favourite episodes are when they get very nervous around women we all fancied when we were children. The Gillian Anderson episode of Off Menu is two men desperately struggling to engage with the fact that they're in a room with Gillian Anderson.
I mean, you know.
Where do you get your news from?
You.
What? The worst news source of all time.
I get it from you.
The worst news source of all time. Surely we both get a lot of news from your former employer?
Yeah, I think we're both like sad addicts to news. So yes, obviously, religiously read The Guardian. I also often have the BBC on in the background, read the FT. Also, you know, listening to Navarra often.
Yeah.
Also just like listening to Gary Stevenson. Sorry, I said Gary because he's my friend. Yeah. Often.
Obviously, we are part of the unimpeachable crooked media empire. I really genuinely believe, and this is not just me sucking up to my employers, post-2024, I do genuinely think Pod Save America is trying to like rebuild a kind of proper progressive coalition in the States. It's also really, really important that people get a very balanced news diet. And I think a big part of that is organizations like Reuters and the Associated Press, because, and listen, we're part of the problem, but too much news now is opinion-based. And I know that I am the king of fucking hypocrites talking on our fucking news opinion podcast.
About
there's too much opinion, right? But like, too much of our news has become opinion-driven. And it is really important that we support organizations like the AP and like Reuters, who are doing the actual work of journalism. While we're on the subject of news gathering, it is really important that we engage with the idea of mis and disinformation. So there are great resources out there to help you educate yourself. UNICEF, Childline and Stop Hate UK all have resources, as well as lots of other trusted organisations. The most important question we have to answer right now at this moment is, how do we combat misinformation and disinformation? And if you're in any way interested, I know I bring this book up all the time, but I think it is really valuable that everybody reads Doppelganger by Naomi Klein. I think it is the book that is best positioned to grapple with these questions about online misinformation. And I just think she's so incredibly intelligent and prescient, and everything that she has written about feels a couple of steps ahead of where the conversation moves to. And I would really recommend, as well as all of your news gathering sources, that you read Doppelganger, because it is so important about this specific issue.
You do read a lot. Where do you get the time? Oh, you're childless, I remember.
I'm childless, yeah.
Coming up after the break, why does the left make it so hard to join the gang? Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Calm.
Is anyone else feeling like this year just flew by way too fast? That where did the time go anxiety is real and can leave you feeling scattered and behind. Calm gives you permission to slow down, even when everything else is speeding up.
The pressure to make the most of the final months of the year is so real. So if you woke up today thinking about 2025 and all the things you should have done, please stop shoulding on yourself. You're doing the best you can. And when the shoulds pile up, calm is the tool to reach for to release stress and find space to breathe, even on the busiest days.
Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, and it's here to help you feel better. If you're feeling like you could use some support navigating life's ups and downs, get the relief you need with Calm sessions like guided meditations to help you work through anxiety and stress, boost your focus, build healthier habits, and take better care of your physical health.
And don't forget the sleep stories, the sleep meditations, and calmer music to help you drift off to restful sleep. And there's grounding exercises to help you reset and relax when you're feeling overwhelmed.
The Calm app puts the tools you need right in your pocket, so stress and anxiety relief is always within reach.
Calm has over 2 million five-star reviews and can help you stress less, sleep more, and live mindfully.
Calm your mind, change your life. Calm has an exclusive offer just for listeners of our show. Get 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/PSTUK. This is an amazing value.
Go to calm.com/PSTUK for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. calm.com/PSTUK and let Calm know you heard about them from us.
Quick question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero handholding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
Okay, this next bit could probably be best summed up by Craig. So there's basically a string of people that I think have asked a similar question.
Yeah.
Why does the left make it so fucking hard? Now, look, he has clarified this, but that would actually be enough of a question to begin with. The right don't care about philosophical purity, but parties like your party require absolutism. The right doesn't care if you've heard of Rand or Hayek, but the left will go on at you about fucking Gramsci as soon as you open your mouth. No, I haven't read him and I'm not going to. I have a job and three kids.
That's kind of amazing.
I think you're probably in a better position to answer this question than me, because it feels like you've been around more of the kind of internal machinations of some of these left-wing movements than I have.
Not really. I've just got like a bunch of activist mates.
Yeah, yeah. And
we are all united, not for our love of Gramsci, but of the rave. So actually, this was kind of
your politics are rave-based.
We're all rave-based. But like, you know, I have also felt being in those spaces as a, you know, a plus one to some of these friends, yeah. Really, that is very, there can be a lot of intellectual sparring.
Yeah.
And I agree that you need to have a kind of theory that underpins a political movement, because otherwise, what is it?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I do feel that you can get lost in that. And there is just a reality that people just check out. I mean, with the puritanical stuff, sometimes I like whinge to my mum about it and she's like, she'll put her hand in my hand and she'll just say, some people need God. And like genuinely, like if you are looking for a rule,
yeah.
A rule system to help you get through the chaos of life, to help you understand how you should be, it's not necessarily going to be politics. There's other philosophies out there that can tell you how to live your life every single day, that can tell you what to buy in that supermarket, or can tell you how to conduct yourself in whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But like maybe party organising isn't really that.
Listen, I definitely think that progressives generally, we'd sort of almost sexually enthralled by infighting with each other. And we are sort of, and I mean that across the like entirety of the political spectrum. If you look at how much political and emotional energy the centre of the Labour Party has expended in not dealing with the problems of this country, but trying to expel the left of the Labour Party from it. Politicians in left-wing parties are obsessed with becoming the leader of the left-wing party. And sometimes it feels like politicians in right-wing countries are obsessed with leading the country.
Mm.
They're obsessed with being prime minister or president. We could definitely stand to be a bit less puritanical. We go on about the broad church so often. What we've learned from the right in the last decade is they will just support each other no matter what. You know, if you think about the amount of Republicans that in 2016 thought Trump was a vile, disgusting man that had no business leading the Republican Party, that now spend all of their time appearing on Fox News to talk about how wonderful the president is, you see that those people do fall in line. Now, I will say, and I have said this before, there is a part of me that is proud of us for our constant infighting. Because when I look at the sort of conservatives that ended up lining up behind Boris Johnson, or when I look at, you know, someone like Theresa May, who went from being a Remain supporter to saying, you know, Brexit means Brexit, there's a part of me that's like, you know what, actually, it would be better if the right did infight a bit. Be better if they actually interrogated their ideas a little bit more. But listen, whilst obviously the Mamdani campaign is a very specific thing because it was, you know, a mayoral election in New York, at the same time, there are really important things that we can learn. And one of the most important things is Mamdani made it seem fun to be left-wing.
Yeah, well, he had a fledgling rap career.
Yeah.
I think it's very important to mention.
But he also made it seem like there was room for a lot of different people in his coalition. And that was, he was able to do that without watering down his core principles. So he did say, you know, we're a movement that is, you know, trans, like inclusionary. We're in favor of the LGBTQIA. We're pro women's rights. We're pro immigrant rights. We're pro people of color rights. But we're also about bringing your bills down. And that, I think, is a really, really important lesson for progressives to learn around the world. Now, this one's for you, Coco. Ariane wants to know, how do I navigate a world that is increasingly AI-focused without becoming overwhelmed? And how do I ensure people know the environmental impact of it without coming across as a boring Luddite?
In what way is this for me, Nish?
You're the podcast AI expert.
That was a
barb. You're the podcast AI expert.
I thought this was a friendly chat.
I don't know about it.
This is why we need a third, because we descend into infighting.
I don't care about, Ariane, it's important for you to know that I don't care about coming across as a boring Luddite. I don't care. I'm happy to do that. It is an interesting question because I spoke to somebody yesterday who said that students at schools are now being encouraged to use it.
Yeah.
So it is interesting. Like, it's sort of fine for me because I'm a stand-up comedian. So
have you ever tried typing in to one of these AI things, write me a joke in the style of Nish Kumar?
No, and I have no interest in doing it because at the same time, I don't believe in just pouring water down the sink for no reason. But I think it's easy for me to take an anti-AI position because it does not intersect with my life in any way. Until there's an AI that can do my goddamn laundry for me. If it can do my washing and then hang it on the line, that is the most odious task I have to do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like the fact that so many great men of their generation have spent time doing this and not, like, you know, making healthcare better,
or making the lives of
care workers better. It really tells you the sort of the life of that
privileged
man.
So it's easy for me to go full Will Smith and iRobot and just ignore it. But it is interesting. How do you navigate a world that is increasingly becoming AI focused?
I mean, like, it's an enormous tension. And certainly doing this show has really made me think twice about every time I have used it. I have used it on occasion and I will genuinely make the kind of equation in my head. Is this justifiable? Is this, you know, is this worth it? And then I'll think, okay, well, I'll have these moments where I'm like, okay, well, I'll do this environmental thing instead. And or I'll do this. I'll try and offset it. And that makes me feel better. But fundamentally, that is an exercise in me feeling better, isn't it? That is a personal exercise about my guilt. And I think sometimes we can get really bogged down into conversations about individual actions and putting that all on individuals whilst at the same time the world is kind of forcing you to act in this way. In the same way that someone who eats meat or drives a car, I probably wouldn't spend time being like, yeah, but do you know this? I would rather just say, okay, well, what I will do is where I recognise that this is bad, I will try and divert my energies into policies and regulations so that those things become less bad.
Yeah, yeah.
I really would like to implore our governments to make it harder for us to use it or for it to be in certain settings or for it to be less financially lucrative to pump this weird stuff that we're forming relationships to in the world, rather than blame the individuals that use it and increasingly be pushed to use it.
My friend Gabriel said something that's like completely blown my mind. He said, if AI was as good as they're saying it is, they wouldn't be forcing it on us. And the reality is, it is being forced on us.
Yeah.
You can't Google something now without the AI mode coming up at the top. Very often that information is a less accurate summation of the information that is just available to you if you scroll down. There's a huge amount about this that is about inflating the value of share prices because the US, the Nasdaq is now sort of heavily dependent on AI stocks.
And the AI companies are currently in their exit plan mode, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're
and
just
so
openly
I think that
like, we're getting
like,
out.
The only thing I can say, Ariane, is just obey the words of Gabriel Abulu, a man who I've not asked permission to just quote him wholesale and say his full name on this podcast, but I'm going to guess he's fine with it. Just think about Gabriel saying, if it was that good, would they be forcing us? Because say what you would about mobile phones and social media, they didn't need to force that on us. We went willingly to those particular gulags because the product was so good and so addictive and interesting that we all embraced it wholesale. Whereas with AI, it feels like it's being pushed on us.
My own journalist colleagues have had to apply for jobs where they've said, okay, and you need to demonstrate that you can use AI to be quicker with the editing, to bring those word counts down, to do those things. Yeah, like it's, you know, it's a thing that is being forced on people, which is why, again, I have this reluctance to say, oh, if you use it, you're a bad person. Also, because I use it. Convenient for me. Let's move on. So now it is the quick fire round. So yes or no, or single phrase answers. That's the rules.
Okay, here we go. At widebleak8138 says, dear Coco, is the human race doomed?
No.
I don't know why they haven't asked me, because I think they assume I'm going to say yes. But is the human race doomed?
No.
Okay, fantastic. Have you rethought your terrible take on Big Lamp?
Oh my God.
That's from a listener situated a couple of meters away at the time of recording, who may, by the sounds of things, be one of the producers of this podcast. Have you rethought your terrible take on a big lamp?
Can I give some context to the listeners who don't understand
Please.
What the big lamp thing is?
Yeah.
I wrote a piece some while ago talking about the big light, you know, the main light that you have in your ceiling.
Yeah.
And there's a style of interiors content that I consume a lot of. And recently I noticed there'd been a lot of disparaging the big light.
Yeah.
And talking about how you should only put on lamps. Yeah. I just live in a household where my partner's very pro lamps. I'm just very frustrated often that I can't see things.
Yeah.
And if I try and read a label, I can't see it. Or if I drop a contact lens, I can't really see it. So we have these little friendly, low stakes debates about the big light. I wrote a piece about it and I had never received so much outpouring. So
I'm with you.
Really
I'm pro big light.
Well, the thing about the big light, it's egalitarian.
Yeah.
You don't need to go out and buy a special lamp. You don't need to walk around the room. Everyone in that room gets light upon them.
Yeah.
It's very fair in that way. I would say big lights, socialist.
So,
lamps, right wing.
So the answer to that question is...
Only for those who happen to be...
No, she has not rethought that take at all. If anything, she's actually evolved it.
She's entrenched.
She's entrenched and she's actually expounded on it. What's the best new mum hack that you've discovered?
I don't think I have any. Hang on.
No hack.
No hack. I'm just...
Just hack through.
Just trying to survive, friend.
Just
surviving.
What are you most dreading about 2026?
That it's a repeat of 2025 and 2024.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you most excited about in 2026?
The end of 2025. Pretty
okay.
tough year,
Fantastic.
Isn't it?
Okay, now...
Okay, now your turn. So Simon Manley 9245 asks, what character class would Nish play if he were to play Dungeons & Dragons?
I admit this is a surprise. I don't know a huge amount about Dungeons & Dragons. The only time I've played is when I've played in charity games organised by my friend Paul Foxcroft. And I have played as a character that I named the Reverend John Butthammer. So I don't know. I'm actually not clear on what character class the Reverend Butthammer is. But I the only thing I can tell you is the Reverend John Butthammer.
So who is Nish's comedy hero or heroine?
I mean, there's like 5 million that I could name. When I was at university, I was given Live in Concert by Richard Pryor. And then I went on a kind of deep study of Richard Pryor's comedy albums that lead up to that and listened to all of them. And it's pretty sort of foundational to me starting stand-up and the style of stand-up that I do. I think right now, probably Maria Bamford and, as much as it absolutely pains me to say this, James Acaster are the two best stand-up comedians in the world. I really believe that. And I know people say he's your friend. That's the reason why it's hard for me to say it. That's the reason why it pains me with every fibre of my being to have to say this out loud. But Richard Pryor is one of my comedy heroes. Right now, I love Roy Wood Jr. I think he's incredible. I think Maria Bamford is so extraordinary. And there's no time to go into this, but there is a technical thing that makes her the closest comedian to Richard Pryor that we've ever had since Pryor. And I do think Acaster is the best stand-up in the world right now.
Wow. Okay, so we've also had a question from Asim Eclectic. They say, a few months ago, Nish absolutely correctly called Midnight Vultures Beck's best album.
It is Beck's best album, no matter what James Acaster says. Carry on.
In the spirit of high fidelity, what are your top 5 albums? They've asked for 5, but for the sake of the quickfire nature of this round, you can only pick one. That's such a tough question, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't even know where I start.
That question.
Like, just off the top of my head, without thinking about it, I'll just name the five albums that come into my head now.
This is quick. No, you can't just break the rules. You have to pick one. That's the rules, man.
I mean, it's really difficult. I'll do five really quickly. Bring It All Back Home by Bob Dylan. Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. To Pimp a Butterfly by Kendrick Lamar. The White Album by the Beatles. I can't believe I said the White Album. The Greatest by Cat Power.
And no Outkast in there.
But that's like a separate top five.
Okay.
I don't even know how to get into that.
Okay.
Also, if it was Outkast, I would definitely pick Speaker Box and The Love Below. But that's also two albums.
Okay.
I'm really trying to. You've done really well there.
Yeah. What are you dreading most about 2026?
What am I dreading most? More reform. Mm. Just more reform. And also the thing that I'm genuinely dreading is an escalation of the
summer
race riots.
Yeah, that's the thing
I'm dreading most.
What are you most excited about?
I'm actually going to see Cat Power perform The Greatest in full. It's one of my favourite albums ever. And she's doing a tour where she does it in full. And I'm also going to see Geese. Because the two key points of connection I have with Gen Z are the band Geese and my anxiety disorder.
Finally, listeners, we want to know who you want us to invite on the podcast in 2026. Dream big and we will try to deliver. Email us at psuk@reducelistening.co.uk or drop a note in the comments.
And that's it. Thanks for listening to Pod Save the UK. Don't forget to follow at Pod Save the UK on Instagram, TikTok and Twitter and Blue Sky.
Pod Save the UK is a Reduced Listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to lead producer Mae Robson and digital producer Jacob Liebenberg.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Patopoulos.
Our engineer is Jeep Asani and our social media producer is Nada Smiljanic.
The executive producers are Kate Fitzsimons and Katie Long with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
Remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes.
Question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.